Good morning, all. I'm going to introduce Uwe Korn, that will talk about parquet in practice and detail. I remember you that at the end of the session, the presentation, you can ask questions to Uwe. We have 5 minutes. And so have a nice talk.
Okay, hello, I'm Uwe. I'm going to speak a bit about parquet today. I'm going to show you a bit what parquet is doing internally and what makes it a bit efficient and why you should actually use it. Okay, I'm a data scientist, so I'm not anyone who's operating something, or actually I am, and that's a bit due to parquet. I'm committed to Apache Arrow and Apache Parquet. In my daily work, I work in Python, Siphon, which is a kind of compiled Python, C++, 11, and SQL. I rarely work in Java, and mainly most of my colleagues don't want to touch any Java, or they only work in Python and SQL. What's the benefit for us with that? We write a lot of data science models at my company, and we enabled our data scientists, they can write their models in Python, they're quite used with that, and we enable them to deploy their models directly into production, so no one has to rewrite them. But for that a bit, a very important component is parquet, because it allows you to plug it, to shift your data between systems. A little bit of background about the company where I work. Pluyonda is a software as a service company. Our customers are retailers like supermarkets, and we do replenishment optimization, meaning that they tell us how many they have in stock, what the logistics data is, and we tell them you should order so much that you don't have too much waste or that it doesn't go out of stock. The basic use case here is we have a lot of time series data, and that's where you really can store really good in parquet, and we want to feed this time series data into our machine learning models. Overall, in the talk, I'm going to talk a bit about where parquet is coming from, why you should use it, and why you should use it. Then I'm going to talk a bit how parquet is made up as a file, how you could use it, and what makes it inefficient in the use cases where you should use it. At the end, I'm going to show you a bit that we now have Python and C++ integration. It sadly has not been released. It's probably going up for vote for the initial release next week. And that's kind of the new interesting stuff happening in the parquet space, that we have these two languages now also added and have a stable, fast library for them. Parquet itself, it's a columnar on-disk storage format, mostly meaning that you can use it to persist tables on disk or on your HDFS or on S3 or so. It started 4 years ago by Cladera and Twitter. They have had log-like data. They wanted to store efficiently and query efficiently. Log-like data, time series data, a bit about my use case. And a year later, it became an Apache project. There was a 1.0 stable release. And yeah, more people started adopting it. And now, just recently, we came to the point where we now have full support for parquet in Python and C++, as I just mentioned slide before. Sadly, didn't get a release until ApacheCon, but will hopefully be next week. And one of the interesting things, it's about a state-of-the-art format in a Hadoop ecosystem. It's not the only format you can use, it's several others, but it's quite often used as the example one which you should start. And for example, if you go to the Spark tutorial about SQL, data frames, and so on, they talk a bit about, okay, you can read in a JSON, and so on, and so on. And at one point, they just say, okay, there's also parquet. Use this if you want to have a bit more performance and if reading JSON is taking you too long. They don't really talk about why you should use it, but they just say, oh, use it. And it's also, it's kind of available in really much everything in the Hadoop ecosystem. So it also gives you the benefit that you can exchange data between the systems in parquet, and you're not bound to one system with using it. Why should you use parquet? Parquet is a columnar format. It means that if you only access to some columns of your data and not all of your data, you only have to read those columns. But also, as the data is stored columnar, You can use such things as vectorized operations, meaning you can easily run a for loop over the data in there, but also storing things in a comma format means that if you have compiled code or if your JIT is running over it, it will see that, okay, there's a memory stream with all the same data, and then I can use these fancy things like SSE and AVX instructions and make it really fast. And that is one thing the compiler does for us in reading Parquet files. We get those instructions automatically because it's code the compiler understands and can make it fast for us. On top of our columnar data, we then in Parquet apply encodings and compressions. The things are both are similar. Encodings are a bit like, okay, I know the data, I can use an algorithm to shrink this data down, and I don't need much CPU, but I have to assume something about the data. Compression, on the other hand, it doesn't assume anything about the data, but it takes a bit more of CPU, but it will still get you a smaller data size, but at a higher cost. And another thing, also in the log case or so, you maybe don't want to have, want to access all data every time fully into your framework. You actually want to only do computations on a subset of data. And Parquet supports something called query pushdown or predicate pushdown. And that's the ability that if you have a query and you know what the query is doing, maybe having a work clause, that you only load this data where you need into your memory, meaning that as parts of your computations can already be executed in the I/O layer so that you save on the I/O and don't have the feeling if you start a computation, you first load everything RAM, you see, okay, you don't need 90% of data and then throw it away again. And another cool thing about it is, we have now that we have also a lot of native libraries, you can use it in Java, in Scala, in C++, and in Python. You save it in Python, you load it in Java, it's the same data. It's a different API in the libraries, but in the end, you can shift data type safe from one system to another. And you see that in a bit of broad support. Nearly all query engines that do this hard-hitting SQL or so support Parquet. But also, all the machine learning frameworks or processing frameworks support Parquet. Here in bold is Pandas, which is the typical option if you're developing in Python and you have tabular data and you want to make operations in memory on it. And now, with the C++ support and thereon the Python support, you actually can use this in Pandas. You could use it before because there was you could load the data in Spark, Parquet data in Spark, and call in Spark to Pandas, but it was awfully slow, where it was just cheaper to save the data as CSV. Now you can just use Pandas directly without having some kind of intermediate layer because there's native libraries. One of the cool things here is, our data scientists do many stuff in Pandas, do their ad hoc analysis in Pandas, but at the end, they can only load a subset of the data in RAM because we have huge data. But when they do large-scale analysis, they use a query engine. All of those query engines are in Java, so it's not in the language native to our data scientists. But you can pass to them SQL, so their analysis in SQL will run on them. They won't do any modifications of the code of Impala or Trill or so. Impala is not Java, but won't do any modifications there because that's not the area which they are comfortable with. But it gives them a uniform interchange, so you can go on a low scale, take the data, make analysis in Python, go on a large scale, use Java, use any Java-based tool, and don't have to deal with Java, but still can analyze it. Parquet is not only about a single flat table. It's about tables with nested data in there. Nested data means that there's not only leaf columns, but there are some kind of super columns which consist of several columns. Like in my example, which is kind of not so good readable here, you have here on the right side a name column, and this name column consists of an URL and a language column. And the basic thing if you want to store this kind of nested data in a flat file or on a flat table is, okay, then you just use the first name and use the name of the subcolumn and concatenate them together with a point. That's a quite straightforward solution. That's what we're doing, and that's what's also partly named in the Google Dremel paper. But if you're just doing that, you're losing some information. One of the important informations which you have to encode is if there's maybe a null value. Maybe URL is null or your name is null. If you only look at the URL column and you need that information, if you have a document which has no name, or is it just a document which has a name but no URL, that's also something you need to encode in your data. In Parquet, we're doing that in something called definition levels. I'm not going to go into very much detail with them, but on the web link here, Julian is describing really good what definition levels are and also what repetition levels are. Repetition levels are the way for Parquet to encode arrays in a column. So if you have a column, it must not only be consist of maybe that each row has a scalar value, but also in a in-run row, you could have an array so that each row has maybe a million elements in it or so. And to represent that as still as an array of scalar values, we're using repetition levels. Mainly, those things just tell you, okay, this is I'm in column one, and this is the second element or so. A bit more detail on the block. Is everyone here familiar what is columnar data and why we actually use columnar notations for a 2D table? Hands up. Okay, not so many. Okay. The basic thing is tabular data. It's a 2D format. That's when you look at your monitor or display, this is what you're going to see. Sadly, this is not what your disk storage or your RAM looks like. You normally want to have addressing that as one-dimensional, so just indexed by an int. But you have to decide, do you want to put it row-wise, each record after record, or do you want to put it column-wise? Typical old-school databases, they would choose a row-wise layout. Because, for example, in the use case of a weblog, if you go on a website, you want to have a row of your table telling you what's the title of the blog entry, what's the creation date, and what's the content. That in this use case, you want to have one chunk or the whole record at once, and then row layout is kind of the comfortable way to do. Otherwise, when we have analytical workloads, we normally have queries like, okay, give me the median price or the mean price of all my products in my database. For that, I don't need to know the name of the product, but I actually only need to go over my last column in which all my prices are located. And therefore, I shouldn't pass any of the data which is not relevant for my computation through my L layer or from my CPU caches. But instead, I can just go to the CPU, use my full memory buffer, and push through just the data which I need for the price computation. And that even brings us to the point where we can use vectorized operations on a CPU. Typically, a CPU will only do, in a cycle, a single computation. But we have things like SSE, which is the principle of SIMD, which is single instruction, multiple data. And then you can have a single operation on maybe 8 values in one CPU cycle, meaning you get an 8-time speed up in your CPU and just by having a good memory layout. But also, when you pull data into your CPU, you're normally not pulling it byte for byte from memory, but your memory bus will maybe pull 64 bytes or a kilobyte at once. And the less data you waste or throw away afterwards, the faster your operations will be. And for analytical layout computations, columnar layout is exactly what we want. Because there, every data we want will come at once. So, now after having introduced a bit of columnar, we're going to look at how a Parquet file is structured. Normally, if you just look at a file system, there is this one big block which is called file. It has a name, and it's the thing you want to access. In most use cases where you use Parquet, you normally have a lot of files of Parquet stored at your disk. Because your data set is maybe a terabyte big, and your computation will be run in parallel, and each job will write its result as a single Parquet file. A file is something which file systems can really deal good. They're used to it, and they will just even, maybe it's an object store, it will use this one file and store it maybe at one location using hashing. But actually, for Parquet, it's not so relevant that we have a file. A file is something which is named and included in our loading process. But the topmost unit at where we can do parallelization is a rogue group. A rogue group is something which is a chunk of rows which has its own metadata, and it's referenced by the file metadata, but it's normally the highest unit of parallelization. And if you're maybe storing your Parquet data on HDFS, the optimal thing is that your rogue group should be at the size or a bit less than an HDFS block, so it can be loaded efficiently. And then in each of these rogue groups, we have column after column. And all those column chunks in here in the rogue group, I have the same length. And you can already parallelize all your workloads best on a rogue group. And if you have maybe 100 Parquet files, it's not a limit that you can run 100 jobs. But even if the most simple case of parallelization, you can run as many jobs in parallel as you have rogue groups. There's nothing to do with how many files you have. That's mainly a limitation of your file system. But still, when we're doing computations, we know which columns we need. So with those column chunks in here, we know, okay, we only need to load the columns we actually use. But still, it's a format which is mainly laid out for loading many values, but not all values, but loading those many values also in parallel. We have our smallest unit in Parquet, which is a page. A page is normally about a megabyte in size, and that's the smallest unit you can load. For a megabyte of size, you maybe have a million rows in there for this column, or a million records in that case. But that's the point where compression and encoding happens. So if you want to access any value inside of that page, you have to load all values in that page first, and then run decompress everything in there, and then you can work on that. But you can't really work on smaller units than that. That is not so good if you have a row, if you want to access a single record, but it's really beneficial for storing data and for keeping it really small and having then fast access to it. And then, as a use case of Parquet is, you want to do queries on it, and you don't normally want to do queries on all data. We have statistics integrated on a rogue group level, and each page has statistics. The most basic statistics are the minimum and the maximum of a row. So that when you look, should I load this column or this row group or this single page to evaluate my query on the data, I can look at the statistics. Maybe have a filter in there that says, okay, only I want to make the sum over all elements, which ID is larger than 10, smaller than 20. And the statistics tell me, okay, I have a minimum ID of 0 and a maximum of the ID of 15, then this row group is relevant for me because there are possibly values in there that are interesting for me. But maybe the page says, okay, in this page, the maximum is 5. So 5 does not match my query, and I can just skip over it, and I don't have to read it. I don't have to push it through the I/O system. To efficiently store the data, you normally can just dump the data on disk. Then you have, if you append a schema, you can store it and restore it again, and it's fast, and it will give you the same data again. But for the most workloads which you have Parquet, you're storing really large amounts of data. You're not accessing them on a random access, but rather on a batch load. And you're storing them somewhere where you're paying for storage, and you're keeping them a bit longer mostly. So you have to take care of the network bandwidth if you don't do data local computations. So actually, size matters really a lot in those files. But also, CPU usage matters a lot. So we want to have a good combination of not much CPU usage, but also not much network usage. The first thing to achieve that in a kind of cheap or not so CPU intensive way is encodings. Encodings take an assumption about the data. Mostly we have string data with hopefully a lot of repetitions, or we have integer or data or float data. Float data is maybe the worst data we can have. But those encodings then make some assumptions. I'm going to talk about two encodings now, which tie them assumptions. But through that assumptions, we normally can a lot better in CPU usage and just taking simple compression, as we don't have to take care of all cases. But it may fail more often, so compression will always probably get you a smaller size by the cost of a longer runtime. As an example, I took the New York taxi trip record data for last January. It's kind of okay time series data. It is 1.6 gigabyte as a CSV, so it should fit into the memory of every laptop, so you can just try it on your own. It's not the most best format for doing compression with Parquet, so the benchmarks here are rather conservative, and probably it will do better on your data. Internally, I've seen data where we had 10 times as good compression as we will see in the next example. But that's kind of a common data set I found on the internet, which is used in a lot of other queries. And it shows you a bit good about the magnitudes of impact of each of the components. The good things here is that we have some integer columns and some daytime columns, and especially Boolean column, which you can compress really good in Parquet. Float is not so good. I'm going to talk a bit about later of that. But because of the 12 float columns in here, it's a conservative case. The input format is CSV. CSV is text. And because of text, parsing is normally slow. And we have added semicolons in between. The simplest thing to get it faster written is we have a plain encoding in Parquet. It's the most stupid one, which just takes the data as it is in RAM, persists it on disk. But in comparison to a textual format, this is already a benefit because you don't save the semicolons, which gives you a bit smaller file size. But also, as it takes the data just like it is in RAM, you will get the same data again if you read it, and you don't have to do any conversions. But at the end, it's just like any other binary format, it's data dumped on disk with a schema, not giving you any benefit yet. Then we have the most magic thing in Parquet, I think. It's the rung length encoding and bit packing hybrid encoding. It's actually a combination of two simple encodings. But in the end, through combining them, they get a bit more complicated to think about, but they're really effective. They're used for the definition and repetition levels I mentioned earlier, but they also will be used for the next encoding. The idea of that is if you have a lot for bit packing, if you have maybe a data which is just 0, 1, 2, 3, and it's declared as an N64, then you actually say, okay, to my memory layer, 0, 1, 2, okay, I need 8 bytes, it's an N64. But actually, 0, 1, 2, you could represent that data already in just 2 bytes. So because we don't need the benefit of random access, we rather want to store it so we can read and write it fast, we will then only use 2 bytes in Parquet to write it down to the disk.
2 bits?
2 bits, yeah. 2 bits is something which you actually could use your random access for. If you come to a point where you have maybe 3 bits, it gets a bit more nasty if you really want to put it in your memory, because then you would have read data where 1 bit is in another byte than the other 2 bits are. But it already gives us a good good compression. And then if you have data with a lot of repetitions, for example, if you have a time series monitoring or something, typically a sensor will not change every millisecond. But if you take seconds readings and you don't know when it will change, then you probably have a lot of repetitions where it says, OK, it's now 10 degrees, it's 10 degrees, it's 10 degrees. And then just after thousands of measurements, it will say, OK, it's 11 degrees. And you don't want to store all these 10-degree measurements, but you rather want to store, OK, I have 1,000 times 10 degrees and then 2 times 11 degrees. This will shrink it down to also a lot. In Parquet, we're using the combination of those two. Well, always bit packing because we want the smallest possible bit size. But also, if it's possible to reduce rung length encoding, we will apply it. We will apply it we will look always at 8 values and then decide, okay, is it worth to do rung length encoding or is it not? The special point of 8 is just that with the encoding Parquet is using for rung length encoding, it's always the optimal decision to decide after every 8 values. For the data I have here, it's 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1. I'm going to use this as an example, but decide after four values. As you see, the first four values, it's a mixture of two. So we can't do any run-length encoding because it's actually always 1 times 1, 1 times 0, 1 times 1. If you would always write down the counts, you would save, need at least twice the data you have. But it, as you can see, you have already, at the moment, we have an int 4 using 4 bits. But we would only need a single bit to store the information we have. And thus, we can tell in our parquet file, we set the bit for a literal run, meaning it's not run-length encoded, store just the four bits we need to store the four values we have above, and then we go to the next four. And the next four, we see, okay, we have 4 times 1. Then we don't need to save 1, 1, 1, but we can actually store set the bit that we have a repeated run, switch our encoding so that we then write down how often we have this value. We're using a very length integer here, meaning that larger integers will need more space to encode how often we will repeat this value, meaning that if a value is repeated very often, it will need a tiny bit more space than a value that is rarely repeated. But still, it will need less space than if we would just write down every of those values. And then we write down that we have 4 times 1, giving you, I hope I put the dimension quite right, already a good compression here. This is mostly used for the repetition and deletion levels. So for example, encoding if you have a null entry or not, which is normally a really good application for repetition, where you maybe have a column which has 2 nulls and a billion of values. So then you can normally say, okay, I have 500 million of nulls, a single, 500 million of non-null, a single null, and 500 million of non-nulls again. Storing maybe a column, the whole null bitmap in 8 bytes for a billion values, making nullability something very, very cheap in file storage. But what we also use this encoding for is the plain the dictionary encoding. Dictionary encoding is the typical one we will always use on a column first if you haven't configured something else. So in CPP and in the latest Java release, you can now configure on a column basis exactly what encoding you want to use, so that if there's maybe one encoding not performing really good for you, you can just set it manually and maybe have even really good decrease in size or an increase in read performance. Bitpacking is really, what I mentioned first, is really good if you have 0, 1, 2 as values. But maybe you also have only 3 values in your data, but your values are 1,000, a million, and a billion. If you want to apply bitpacking to that, you will still see, okay, I need an int 6, int 32. I can't pack this smaller. What we're going to do with dictionary encoding is we go over all values, we make an array of all those values. We hope they are repeated a lot, so it's worth that we write all those values at the beginning, and then we assign a code for them. The code is the position we write them in. And for the actual data, we then only will store the codes. So if we have the values 1,000, a million, a billion, and they come in this order, we will just store 0, 1, 2. And as these are smaller integers, we can use bitpacking on them, as we hope to get a lot of repetitions. That's one of the basic assumptions we're doing here in dictionary encoding, meaning that if you don't have any repetition in your data, dictionary encoding will not be any benefit for you. It will rather see, okay, after maybe 2 million values, dictionary encoding is not worth it and will switch back to blind encoding. And if you have such data, and you know it beforehand, it may be easier for you if you just configure your data to use blind encoding. Or we have another thing in there, which is kind of a good choice for float measurements, which are totally different, is delta encoding. But also, using this on the New York taxi data already gave us substantial savings, because things like the taxi driver or the location where it started from are typically repeated very often in this data, because the taxi driver is not just driving a taxi once in a month, but it will do it like 100 times in a month. So we will have 100 mentions of his taxi driver ID, and so we don't have to repeat it every time. or can use a smaller code to just represent it. For the performance benchmarks, I did exclude them because we didn't have yet a release and they got a bit better. I will hopefully do a blog post with performance benchmarks. But for the New York taxi data, using dictionary encoding was actually no performance decrease. Because even if you're writing data to a RAM disk, you're writing less data. And dictionary encoding is quite cheap. So because you're writing less data through your IO layer, you actually need less time. And it's quite roughly the same time dictionary encoding adds up is the saving in IO. So that's kind of a nice thing. If your data suits your encodings, the cost of CPU which you have to spend is already eaten up by the savings in your IO layer. A simple example, we have a column with strings inside which tell us maybe the color of t-shirts or so in your data. T-shirt colors are normally maybe three or four of them. In this example, red, blue, and yellow. If you have a data set, you normally will, and it's a denormalized data set, normally that's in every column or every row, there's the mention of the color as a string. If you would save it as text data, it would be quite a lot of data because it's already repeated and often. But what we can do here is we just make our list at the beginning of all colors we will occur in the file, write them at the beginning, assign them a code, 0 for blue, 1 for red, and 2 for yellow. And afterwards, when we want to store the data, we will only store the indices. A kind of optimization in Parquet here is the dictionary and the data itself are stored in separate pages. I have shown you in the first picture that pages are the smallest unit you need to decode, but we have a dictionary per row group. So there will be several data pages for a row group. And here it's so that if you only want to open a single data page, we also have to load the dictionary, but we only have to load a dictionary. You don't have to load the first page, which may contain the dictionary and some data which we don't care about, giving us the advantage that we really only load the relevant data. This is something where it works really good on the data if there's no repetitions, but as I mentioned before, it doesn't work so good on floats. Floats, the main problem, if you have measurements, you have at the end the exponent, which is always the same, and the mantis is the thing you will see it in the beginning, is changing by one or two bits. One approach is to use delta encoding, which then will strip away the exponent a bit. We have someone is already working on doing some better encodings that will explicitly take care of the floats. But at the moment, if you have floats with small changes in them, but still nearly the same values, it's not so good in Parquet. But for that, we can fall back to just universal compression. This will still do really good, because as the values are very similar, you can compress them really good. Takes more CPU, so if you save a file, you will probably notice that saving will take longer. Loading also will take a bit longer, depending on which codec you use. In Parquet, we have, at the moment, support for four codecs. It's LZO, it's Snappy, it's TSIP, and Broadly. Broadly is quite new. There is a patch open for Hadoop, so you will be hopefully able to do with the next major release, so 2.8, when it comes in, but it's not possible yet. But actually, people are already using it in production, and it's kind of the superior choice if you already have GZIP compression. If you can use Broadly, Broadly will perform at least as good, maybe mostly better. But in selecting your compression, you have to do kind of three choices. You don't do any compression. That's when your network is really, or your I/O bandwidth is really good, and you don't want to waste any more CPU. You have kind of a normally really performant network where you still want to have some compression because encoding didn't work as good as before, then the choice is Snappy. Snappy is mainly probably always the best choice if you have no idea where you want to store your data or how your workload is, because Snappy will compress kind of okay, But decompressing is really fast. GSIP is the one which you should use if you want to have really small data. It takes quite some CPU. It also takes quite some CPU in reading, but it gives you really small size. So compared to the dictionary encoding, where we had 22% compression rate, when you apply GSIP on top of the Parquet file, it still shrinks again in half, making it really, really small. But again, this time, the files still shrink, but GSIP takes so much CPU that that loading will get a bit slower. It will be the same performance if you have some kind of cold storage solution where you don't have such a fast network, but if you have it on HDFS or so, GSIP compressed files normally will make your query on or your loading of Parquet files a bit slower. Another important aspect of Parquet, which makes it really good for queries with compression, is that compression and encoding are only applied at the page level. So if you would take a Parquet file and just would use GSIP to compress it, you wouldn't be able anymore to only access parts of the file. You would always need to decompress the whole file and then work on that file again with your engine. So but by having the compression inside of your file format, you can actually still enable all benefits of the format, like accessing part of it or doing query pushdown, while still having smaller size. And still, 11% is a really good compression. I'm seeing, like, even for very repeated data, I can get my data down to 1%, which is really good, but not in this case here. But if you actually want to see what's the problem in your data, we have a new tool, Parquet CLI. It's part of a pull request still, but it's a very nice tool if you have Parquet files. I will upload the slides later, so you can click there on the link. But this is a file where you can use. You can take this tool to change the encodings or the compressions, but it always will give you statistics about your file. And the nice and amazing statistics is the average size of a record in a column. With all those columns of double and int64, if you load in memory, we need 8 bytes. But for example here, in the end with a GSIP compressed file of the New York taxi data, we have the first column, the vendor ID. The vendor ID is the name or the ID of a taxi driver, so a kind of very often repeated value, a value which is kind of large because vendor IDs are in a large scope. But at the end, we don't need that much information. We have maybe some thousand taxi drivers, so we don't need this ID, which has a length of maybe 8 digits or so. And because it's repeated quite often, vendor IDs are kind of similar. We get a really good compression ratio. And at the end, what we save in our column is that we get each record of a vendor ID down to 0.09 bytes, which is less than a bit in average. So meaning that we need less than, so most some of the bits we can use, or sometimes we have a bit which encodes several hundred values of taxi drivers and vendor ID. This is just a nice tool. It's really good if you have Parquet files and you want to tune them a bit more, or you just want to understand how your data index is laid out, or if you want to see what is the culprit column. And in this case, we have latitude and longitude stored as a double. That's not the optimal storage. It may be even better in Parquet if you use latitude and longitude either as decimal or even as string, because latitude and longitude are kind of the same values always. But as float representation, they're not so efficient to compress. And so we get about an average of 2.1 bytes per float, which is still kind of nearly 4 times saving, but it's not as good as probably we could do. And that's something I would tell you. Use this tool if you have Parquet data, look at it, and maybe tune it a bit. And there's also this weird column in the middle. It's maybe not the best thing to understand, but it will tell you about your encodings used in your file. That's the best thing where you look at a manual. But what you can see here is the last column of these encodings is that the last R means we have dictionary encoding, so we applied dictionary encoding to nearly all columns. For Boolean, we don't have any dictionary encoding because Boolean always needs only a bit, so there's no need to make a dictionary. We know all 2 columns. So we directly went to the plain encoding, and the really both two worst columns are the date time pickup and the drop off date time. They're two candidates to use delta encoding because there will probably always be in year 2016 in January, but the second will also always vary, so we only need to save the second. And in these two cases, we actually went in the case, okay, we made dictionary encoding, but we realized dictionary encoding was not the best encoding, so we made a fallback to plain encoding. So after all these encodings, the one of the big features of Parquet is that you can store your data. It's in a flat file. It's not in your database if you do a query on it, so you normally don't have indices on it. But what we have in Parquet is support for query pushdown or predicate pushdown, meaning that if you evaluate a query on top of Parquet, it will still have some of these benefits what indices normally provide you. The most big benefit is if you have a table and you want to say, okay, give me the average count of products that are sold in dollar, I only need two columns, which is the column with the currency and the column with the counts. So with a columnar format, to evaluate that query, I can skip over the columns. I don't need even to load the columns from disk, meaning my query engine can treat the file as it would be only a file with two columns, and the AO load would be just as I have had two columns. In the example, I'm doing now the basic assumption each record or each box is a Parquet page. So just to make it a bit simpler here, as we also are looking at the count of all products sold in dollar, we want to skip over all products which are not sold in dollar, meaning that we don't care about the euro in here. If we have statistics on page level, we can look up, okay, in my first page, my minimum and maximum entry is dollar. In the second page, my minimum and maximum is euros. Euros is not in the range of my where clause, which says where price and dollar. So I can skip that page. And the last one is again dollar, so I have to read the page. And just by doing those skips on the last column, I also know, okay, for the first column, I only need to read the first page and the third page. And actually, what's not great out here is the data which you need to read from disk. Every data else in your Parquet file, if you do query evaluation, is not actually read from disk, and it's not passed over network. And that's the really cool thing. If you have a long-going computation which reads data from disk, you do not only save CPU time, but you also save I/O time by just pushing down your computation graph to the I/O layer. But that's all due to having this minimum and maximum statistics and metadata in Parquet. So the file metadata says you also, additionally to the statistics, the positions in the file where a row group starts, and row groups will give you some pointers where pages start, so that you, if you make a read command, you actually know where you should seek to, or where if you're doing read fully, and where you should start that read. And then you don't need to load the data over network. Coming from Python, the choice actually to use Parquet came a bit of overhead because there was no good Parquet support yet. The main thing for us was we wanted to have a format so we can escape our Python ecosystem. It's really good, the Python ecosystem, and we got lucky that people can actually work productive in it and deploy things in production, but limiting us to Python was kind of a problem because there are a lot of tools which are not Python, which you want to use, and which we don't want to reinvent again. And also, as a lot of people here are probably not from the Python world, I wanted to give a brief overview. What are the other things in Python you can use? And why you actually want to use Parquet if you want to use something from the Hadoop ecosystem and not something else. The basic thing which you normally use if you're in Python and doing data science is HDF5. That's also the format everyone in the physics experiments also use. It's sometimes called NetCDF, which is best on HDF5. And this is really good. It's fast, it's binary, it doesn't deal so good with strings. It's the format we're using for everything where we don't already have Parquet. But there's only native implementation. You can use it in Java, but as it calls down to the native implementation, there is no good Hadoop integration. And it sucks for strings. So if you have string data, it's slow. The alternative, if you have string data, there's message pack. That's binary JSON. That's supported by some tools in Python. It's fast. But as it's binary JSON, the schema encoding in there is not stable. So it will vary between versions. And yeah. What you actually could use to use it also in the Hadoop ecosystem to get something like cross the borders is CSV. CSV just works always. Everything can read CSV. Sadly, it has two drawbacks. It's robust, so doing any columnar computation on that will mean you have to load the whole file. And it's schemaless. So you always have to guess, is this a string column? Is it a float column? Is it a date? Has my date a time zone? Still give you some drawbacks. So in the end, for us, it was a good choice to take Parquet. Parquet was quite, there was already some implementation going on to have Parquet in C++ and Python support. Originally, the C++ code came out of Impala, but it's now as part of a library. That's the thing I'm going to hope we're going to release next week. It's made of two parts at the moment. We have a general purpose part, which you can use to read and write Parquet files into any data structure and with kind of pluggable IO interfaces. So that's the thing you want to use to if you want to integrate maybe Parquet in your C++ database or in other frameworks. And then as with the Java implementation of Parquet, we're going to start to add leaf libraries, which will read in specific data structures and have a bit optimized way for that. For the start, we have integrated Apache Arrow. It's quite a new project, but with Apache Arrow, we already got one big benefit. There are already good conversion routines from Apache Arrow from C++ to Python. And that's the main part for me. I want to have my colleague data scientists being able to load this data in Python, load it really fast, and don't care much about it. And for that, we could use Apache Arrow. We didn't really need to write a lot of code in Arrow to enable Parquet access in Python. All we did was write a simple function which takes an Arrow Python IO interface, pushes that to the C++ implementation of Parquet, gets back a C++ Arrow structure, wraps a small Python object around it, and then we can work with it in Python. And convert the Arrow to our Python things we have. Mostly, this is zero copy, just adjusting some metadata. If you want to try it out, and it will be in the release of 0.2 of Arrow, but at the moment, you have to read the docs and build on your own. That was basically everything about Parquet, which you should give you a brief overview. If you want to get involved, it's typically all the normal Apache links. If you want to ask questions, there is only a dev mailing list. We don't have a user mailing list, but we have since 2 weeks a Slack, and you can join us on Slack and ask questions about Parquet there. That was it, and I'm now open for questions.
Streaming. So from my understanding, there are that one of the very strong benefits of Parquet is for when there are data repetitions, because data gets compressed and you get better statistics, therefore at querying time it's faster and so on and so forth. When you have streaming, you want regular checkpoints. How do we make the best of both?
Maybe one thing for that would be maybe in the just presentation before that was the presentation of Kudu. Kudu is taking some kind of the idea of Parquet, but taking a bit away of the immutability, because Parquet, you write a file and you have the file written. In Kudu, you can take those ideas and then append to the data. Kudu is, in comparison, Parquet is a file format, Kudu is a database. But also, if you're just going to append data, what you can do is just write down in an Afro file or so, or write Afro records. And what what maybe I think Parquet is coming out, I'm not sure about that, is the people at Twitter maybe had already files with Afro records in them, but they wanted to store them efficiently. So they started with the tool, with the library Parquet Afro, and used that to write Afro records to Parquet to have them more efficiently. But for streaming, it's better to ask someone else. I'm rare in a batch-oriented world.
Okay, it works like this? Okay. During the exposition of the kind of how the file works, so you have file, raw file, the columns, the pages, and these kind of things, I don't get if there's somewhere like a sort of offset, so header that tells you if you want to read this column, you have to go to this offset inside of the file or not, because it was not represented, so.
Yeah.
I mean, otherwise I don't get how the reader is able to move fast from one point to the other. Yeah, that part.
Actually, the statistics also include where you should move to. We have statistics. Statistics come along with metadata, and we have on a file level, we have on a row group level, and on a column level those offset pointers. They will always tell you where is the beginning of the first data page, where is the beginning of the dictionary, and where does this row group begin, and that. And these are also not compressed, so the metadata is very small and not compressed, so you can actually just randomly access it and don't need to do any big encoding. It's Thrift encoded, so that's something you need to encode, but Thrift encoding is quite fast for that small amount.
Thanks.
Okay, no more questions?
Okay, and in case I'm writing a file with uppercase file with Hive, Impala, or stuff like this, I mean, I just have to say, I mean, normally I say store it as Parquet, but to get all this kind of compression and cool feature, do you have to do something, or the writer is already so smart to do
normally
all the work?
Normally it's smart. Normally it's you have some defaults. Typically the default is to go dictionary encoding for all columns, use plain encoding for Boolean columns, because their dictionary makes no sense. And I think depending on your execution engine, it will apply delta encoding to some columns. So there's already some, the good choice is already implemented. If you really know much about your data and you want to get it smaller, you can tune it. But normally the default is quite okay and quite good.
Okay.
So
thanks.
Normally the default is also snappy compression, so it's nothing you should do.
Okay. Yeah.
So no more questions then. I think Apache Con Big Data is over.
Yes, but there is lunch. If you want to make another question, we have time. Yeah. No more. So have a good lunch, and see you in the next talks. Thank you, Uwe.